Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. Today, we're going to host our monthly installment of The Merge. This is a chance for you to hear from our top experts at Mitchell Institute about the key aerospace issues that are making headlines in Washington, D.C. and beyond. Our goal here is to cut past the sound bites and give you a background and insight regarding the underlying issues in play. And so with that, I'd like to bring on Mitchell Institute's Dean, Lieutenant General retired David Deptula.
Hey, thanks, Slick. Great to be here.
Sir, always a pleasure chatting. We also have our Executive Director, Doug Berkey.
Hey, Slick. How's it going?
Going great. Really looking forward to this one, Doug. Thanks for making it. We also have our Director of Future Concepts and Capabilities Assessment, Mark Gonzo Gunzinger.
Hi, Slick.
And then rounding us out, we have our Senior Fellow, Heather Lucky Penny.
Great to be back, Slick. Good to see you.
All right. What I'm really excited about for this episode is to introduce a new voice to our mix, but we're going to get to that in a second. So to kick things off, I'd really like to begin about talking about national security space. And as many of you know from our past episodes, especially when we talked to the Chief of Space Operations, General Jay Raymond, the challenges facing our nation in this lane are very serious. And you know, whether we're talking about civilian economic issues or military operations, nearly everything these days depends on the functions of assets that reside in orbit. So the Mitchell Institute has been an active player in these discussions over the past several years. And in this past week, we unveiled a major undertaking that's making huge headlines here in D.C. So General Deptula, I'm going to turn it over to you. Can you bring us up to speed on what we're up to in this space? And please introduce our newest team member.
Yeah, you bet, Slick. Now, it's no secret that ever since we founded Mitchell Institute in the fall of 2013, I've wanted to dial up attention on national security space issues. With our space speaker series and the studies that we have done that focus on space, we have put a bit of attention in this regard. But with the stand up of the Space Force and the Space Command, it was clear that we really needed to increase the scale and scope of our efforts. And that demands the right talent. We started this search last year, and this past week, I was very proud to announce that the Honorable Matt Donovan is joining us to lead the Mitchell Institute Space Power Advantage Research Center, or MySpark for short. Now, to most folks out there, Mr. Donovan's a defense pro, second to none, and people know that. But for folks who don't, he served for three decades in the Air Force as a fighter pilot in the world's greatest fighter, the F-15, C model, I might add. He was also a key staffer on the Senate Armed Services Committee, where he oversaw the Air Force's key accounts and worked closely with those who were working space. In 2016, he was asked to serve as the Undersecretary of the Air Force, where he once again oversaw space activities and was a key leader who worked behind the scenes to encourage the realization of the Space Force. Little known factoid, but he was an advocate from way back when, laying out the rationale for a separate service for space in a paper back in the late 90s. And he wrapped up his tenure in the Air Force as the acting Secretary of the Air Force before he moved to the third floor of the Pentagon as the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. Now, knowing Matt's incredible experience and commitment to realize a robust national security space enterprise, he was a natural leader for our new center. And I really want to emphasize this. The space community won big time when Mr. Donovan agreed to join us because they now have a tremendous and well-respected advocate on their side. And Matt will not be alone. We've got two additional experts joining us at Mitchell who we'll introduce in future episodes. So Matt, I just want you to know how much we appreciate that you chose to join the Mitchell team and welcome on board.
Well, thanks, Dave. I tell you, I could not be more excited to join Mitchell. I've been a close follower of all the work that you've done for many years. Since you stood this up, I've had the opportunity to speak at many of your events and really enjoyed it thoroughly each time. It was very thought-provoking, and your advocacy and voice is just, second to none in this area on air and space issues. So I'm pleased as punch to be here.
Well, sir, I'm super excited to be able to have you here on the Aerospace Advantage and ask you the first question of this episode of The Merge. So I'd like you to walk us through what you think are the biggest challenges and opportunities for the Space Force and for Space Command.
Well, there are several, but let's start back. David mentioned that I've been an advocate for an independent Space Force for a long time. The paper he was referring to, I wrote when I was in SAS. The School of Advanced Air Power Studies. So it was even before they added space to that name. And then in 2007, when the Chinese launched their ASAT missile and destroyed one of their own satellites in space, I wrote an op-ed calling for the same thing for an independent space force. And then, along with the Rumsfeld Commission report, the Commission on National Security, Space and Organization and Management that came out in 2001, even though it wasn't signed by Rumsfeld because he got picked to be the Secretary of Defense, as everyone knows. And then the efforts of Representative Mike Rogers and Jim Cooper in 2017, when they were pushing the concept of a Space Corps in the NDAA as well too. But the previous administration, in collaboration with the Congress, I think made an explicit acknowledgement of what's going on in space as far as the threats emerging from our adversaries, namely China and Russia, and took a very highly visible action in response to that. So that being said, as the Congress worked through the various provisions that stood up a Space Force, especially on the Senate side, the Senate's known as a very deliberative body, and they didn't want to do it so quickly. In fact, they generally like to take many years to contemplate and deliberate and think about those things. But there was a lot of pressure on them, not least of which came from the external threat. As well, and the need for the U.S. to respond in some way to ensure our national security, especially in the space domain. So now to get to your point about challenges, right now, I think we're faced with a declining budget environment. You know, we keep hearing flat budgets. In fact, President Biden made the announcement a couple of weeks ago when he gave the top line numbers for all the various federal organizations, and it's about a 1.5% increase for the Department of Defense budget. And so when people think, well, that's not so bad, let's put that into a little perspective. Going along with that is the elimination of the Overseas Contingency Operation budget funding line, which in 2021 was $68.7 billion. So in 2022, that's going to be zero. All of our overseas contingency operations are not going to go away. And even if we pull out of Afghanistan by September 11th, as the president announced, that's not going to equal $68 billion in savings or even $22 billion in savings, as I've seen come out of other articles. There's going to be significant costs that are now going to be plowed back in and handed as bills to the services. So when you look at the Department of the Air Force, they go from one service to now two services within the same budget. That's going to be a significant challenge when they get handed those bills. And they're going to have to advocate very strongly within the Department of Defense to hold on to what they have. And hopefully they won't take the easy button route like they have in the past, which is just split it up three ways and hand it out to the departments that's built. That's not a very threat-based approach. So that's, when you take that in combination with the pass-through budget, which I've been a strong supporter of moving that out of the Air Force budget line in the past, and I know you've held, Mitchell has held specific events talking about that with members of Congress and that sort of thing. When you add all these things up, we're looking at a pretty bleak outlook, I think, for defense. So it's going to take some strong advocacy to look at that. The second one is probably the alignment of authorities and responsibilities. So in the NDAA that created the Space Force, they also created a couple of other positions that have not been filled to this point. The first is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Space. That has not been filled yet with anyone besides acting. Within the Department of the Air Force, they created an Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Space Acquisition and Integration. That has never been filled on a permanent basis. So I'll be anxiously awaiting to see who gets the nod as the nominee for that position, because that's going to establish a lot of the way the alignment will be going. But, you know, ostensibly the Space Force was created so that we could align all the different space capabilities, at least within the Department of Defense, together. And the Congress was reticent to do that. And I think there's a lot of room for adjustments as we go forward with that too. I just saw an article the other day that the Army has approved the planning for their space sensor layer. And as you read through the article, there's nary a mention of the United States Space Force or, you know, United States Space Command establishing requirements or anything like that. So that's a problem there as well, too. And then finally, I think it's the ability for the Space Force to transition into a warfighting organization. So I think General Jay Raymond has done a great job setting the conditions for this to happen. You know, he came out with his capstone space document last year. He came out recently with his Chief of Space Operations planning guidance where, you know, he lists his priorities with developing joint warfighters and a world-class team as one of his top priorities. So I think, you know, I bring it up last, but it's probably the number one thing that we need to advocate for and assist where we can is to get space and Space Force into the warfighting mindset. And I'll be concentrating on that a lot and a lot of the work that I'll be doing as well.
Sir, I really appreciate that. So, you know, this week you released an op-ed where you discussed adversary activities in space. And I'm just curious, what's your take on the threat environment right now? Is this a big factor that sold you on the need for a separate space service?
Well, as I mentioned, I've always been an advocate of it. I think in August of 2018, as the Congress was contemplating and deliberating over the NDAA markups on creating the Space Force, you know, they didn't really, in their markups, make any changes to Title 10. So I wrote an op-ed, really is a longer article in War on the Rocks, talking about the need to actually amend Title 10 to create a separate and equal service in the United States Space Force. But, you know, I think since the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, the so-called peace dividend, we've sort of, you know, been the world's sole superpower. You know, I think we relaxed off of our, you know, anomalous history of having a long-term standing military force for the 40 years of the Cold War. And then, of course, you know, all through the 90s, there were dust ups around the world. And then, you know, 9/11 hit us. We've been distracted by counterterrorism, counterinsurgency type operations ever since. And I think that we've lost the muscle memory on how do we mobilize our military to go to war, if necessary, against a great power state, nation state. And so, with the distractions of everything that's going on in the Middle East, I think we finally have seen enough saber rattling out of our adversaries in Russia and in China. And even General Raymond has come out and made some rather stunning public statements about what the Russians are doing as far as maneuvering some of their satellites close to our satellites. ASAT tests and that sort of thing. So, you know, the United States always considered space as a benign domain. and a benign and peaceful domain. We did not choose to weaponize space. Our adversaries chose to weaponize space. So we have got to respond in a way that's responsible and provides for the common defense.
Hey, Matt, Gonzo, when you engage with Capitol Hill this year, and you certainly have a lot of experience doing that and success as well, what are going to be some of your other priorities? You already talked about budget and alignment of responsibilities, but are there other messages you would carry forward? What's the top priority action that would really help transition the Space Force and Space Command to warfighting institutions?
Well, I think the first part of the question is we've got to engage. Everybody has to engage. We've got to keep it in the forefront of the minds of the people who establish policy and allocate resources that, hey, we've got a fledgling Space Force here that's on its, growth path, and we need to make sure that it continues to grow so that it can, execute the functions that it was designed to do, which is warfighting. The establishment, as I mentioned in my op-ed, the establishment of the Space Force and the reestablishment of Space Command were not political gimmicks, even though you might read that's what they were. They were very highly visible actions that we had to display to our enemies, to warn them and maintain deterrence, and also reassure our allies, partners, and friends as well, too. I think it's just important. And, Mitchell has a long history of holding events up on Capitol Hill. And I hope as, people get vaccinated and we can open up more events, then we'll certainly go up there and be able to talk to members of Congress and staffers, who are doing all the work up there to make sure that we just stay in the front of their minds.
Sir, thank you. It's really great to have you on board with the Mitchell team and leading my spark. In your previous responses, you've talked a lot about that space is a warfighting domain. And this is not, a choice. This is something that our adversaries are already doing, and that standing up the Space Force and Space Command is just an acknowledgement of the reality of our need to compete there. So, that being the case, what are your thoughts on the importance of this new service developing a warfighting attitude now that they're on their own?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's what they were created for. And, the Air Force has fought over the years, the label of being the support force, the enabler force, that sort of thing. They've done a pretty good job. And with the help of folks like General Deptula, we've quashed that notion in many ways. The Space Force, I think, is going to have to disabuse folks of that notion as well, too. I mean, the Space Force can't be seen as the internet service provider for the DOD. I mean, they've got to develop capabilities. And to me, it's really three essential elements that any warfighting organization has to have. And the first is identification, right? And that's what we're talking about, space situational awareness and ISR and understanding, enemy movements and intent and that sort of thing. Then they have to have attribution. They have to be able to understand where a threat or an attack or that sort of thing is coming from. And then probably the most important element they need is retribution. They need to have the ability to strike back. So that when you take all these things together, that's what forms deterrence. It forms it in any domain, but it's really important in the space domain that, hey, we can see what you're doing. We can defend our assets against what you're doing. And if you try to do something that's out of the norm or attack our assets, then we're going to attack you back. One of the biggest things that came out of the 2017 National Security Strategy was that we had a declaratory policy for cyber in there. So in other words, you know, they what the declaratory policy said was, look, if you attack us in the cyber domain, we're going to respond in the time and place and domain of our choosing. That's what really is the essence of a joint warfight, right? So, you know, we probably need a declaratory policy in space as well, too, that if you attack our space assets, we're going to respond in a time and place and domain of our choosing, which is the joint piece of it, right? And you may not exactly respond in the same domain and where you were, you know, the infraction occurred. And I think that's important. And I would encourage the administration as they develop their new national security strategy to consider putting that in.
All right. Any other questions or comments for our new Space Research Center Director?
I just want to jump in and say, just listen to Matt's comments here. It is so obvious we made the right call here. And so pleased that he's joining us. It's already upping our game so much. And so, Sarah, just thanks for being here.
Great to have you here.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And you guys are a world-renowned crowd, and I'm very glad to be associated with it.
Well, thanks again for that, sir. Well, we're going to move on to our next topic. And what we're about to talk about is the state of air-delivered munitions. So normally on the Aerospace Advantage, we've talked about aircraft when it comes to air combat, but airplanes are not the end of the kill chain. We need to get to the weapons delivery portion, ending that kill chain, and that's how we're going to bound our conversation today. So we're going to focus on air-to-ground weapons, and after fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan for nearly two decades, we've really focused on a very limited range of threats. So we took our eye off the ball regarding challenges we'd see facing a peer threat like China or Russia. So we need to evolve what's in our toolkit. So we've written a fair amount about this. And so to kick it off, I'd like to turn it over to Gonzo. And Gonzo, can you help bring our listeners up to speed to understand the parameters of this discussion?
Sure, Slick. Thanks. I'm going to kick it off by briefly addressing three points to kind of frame this issue. Why new weapons are needed, what kind of weapons are needed, and finally, the cost to achieve an effect on a target. First, the why. So the Air Force talks about the need for fifth-gen weapons to complement its fifth-gen stealth aircraft, such as F-22s, F-35s, future B-21s, and so on. Well, why is that? You know, the Air Force has also said that precision guidance technologies have changed how it conducts strike campaigns. Instead of using hundreds of sorties and thousands of unguided bombs to kill a target like it did in Vietnam and even more so in World War II, frankly, PGMs, precision-guided munitions, allow our strike aircraft to kill multiple targets per sortie. In Desert Storm, our Air Force has used slightly less than two PGMs per target on average, and that dropped about 1.5 PGMs during Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003. The problem is, today we're in a world where China, Russia, and other adversaries have defenses that can defeat individual weapons or never designed to penetrate contested airspace. So imagine how many sorties would be needed in a war with China or Russia if the Air Force had to use 5, 6, or 7 weapons per target. Yeah, it simply doesn't have the force structure and it can't crank that number of sorties thanks to force structure divestitures over the past 30 years. So that brings me to my second point, which is what kind of weapons are needed. You know, instead of simply throwing more sorties and legacy weapons at this problem, a better answer is to field new weapons that can penetrate enemy defenses, that can survive to reach their targets, have a higher probability of actually reaching their targets. And that's why the Air Force is buying low observable munitions, such as JASSMs, precision-guided missiles that can fly at hypersonic speeds to counter an enemy's ability to detect them and launch and intercept and so on. And that brings me to my third point, cost-effectiveness. Those fifth-generation survivable weapons will be more expensive than legacy weapons such as the $45,000 Joint Direct Attack Munition. Now, at the extreme, some very long-range weapons like the Army's Service Launch Boost Glide LRHW it could cost $40 million or more per round, or better said, $40 million per target is used to attack. But the good news for air launch weapons is there's a sweet spot in terms of range and cost. a sweet spot for these new weapons. And that is somewhere between weapons that have a range somewhere between 60 nautical miles after launch out to about 200 or 300 miles. Because weapons in that shorter range band are generally small enough to be carried internally in significant numbers by stealth aircraft, especially bombers. They're cheap enough to be bought in large numbers. And of course, numbers count, given a JFAC may have to strike 60 to 70,000 targets in a fight with China or Russia. Just one example, I mentioned the JASSM already. The JASSM-ER, which is a low observable penetrating cruise missile, costs about $1.17 million each. But the cost that really counts, the metric really counts, is the cost per target, not just the unit cost. So I've kind of framed the issue for us there.
Let me jump in here, Gonzo. You've kind of outlined the broad areas. Let me jump into some specifics here. And you kind of alluded to it. You talked about fifth gen, but many of us have been talking about the fact that we now have fifth gen aircraft, but they're still equipped with third generation weapons. So it is good news that the Air Force recently unveiled a broad agency announcement. They did it in October of last year to acquire a new and highly flexible ground attack munition to replace the decades old Mark series, and even JDAMs are getting long in the tooth. So what it wants to do is assemble a global precision attack weapon. That's the new lingo. And then the acronym is GPAW. And it's designed to meet, or it's intended, I should say, to meet an ambitious set of characteristics, such as it's got to be small, lightweight, affordable in numbers, yet capable against hard and deeply buried targets, and incorporating advanced sensors and autonomy. So looking at that, I think there are really five key attributes that are inherent in any such design going forward. And the first and the most important one is adaptability. It's got to be able to perform on a multitude of different platforms, got to be data link capable so it can hook up into the combat cloud, can accomplish multiple tasks and be multi-mission per aircraft. That's kind of number one. Number two, lethality. It's got to have dialable effects from inside the cockpit. Number three, logistics. It's got to be rapid to market and rapid to be able to replenish, ease of forward basing. Number four, reliability. Obviously, that kind of goes without said. And then finally, the one you brought up, and what everyone tends to focus on is cost. So that needs to be refined as this thing goes on. But it's good news that the Air Force is finally headed in this direction. And I really think technology today will allow us to build a single weapon that can do both soft targets and hard and deeply buried targets. So we don't have to scramble with, you know, we get, I'll tell a short war story from Enduring Freedom. You know, we had special intelligence that, you know, UBL might be located in the Tora Bora area. So the folks on board the carrier that was in the vicinity were jumping through their rear, downloading Mark 83s and uploading bombs with a Bluey 109 casing on them. And if we had a modern munition that could do both, we wouldn't have to run through that. We just take the weapon out, and if it's a hard and deeply buried target, you hit button A, and if it's a soft target and you want to reduce the impact of collateral damage, you hit button B. So I'm glad to see the Air Force is headed in that direction.
Yeah, I agree, Dave, completely. There are trade-offs, of course, between the multi-mission capability of those weapons, their range, their cost, and their survivability. And we've written extensively on the range issue. Now, it's easy to make a weapon with longer range by cutting the size of its warhead. And frankly, that can change the kinds of effects it can create. It's not going to be able to kill hardened and deeply buried targets, for example. Plus, you go from those mid-range weapons, you know, 60 to a couple hundred miles, that are suitable to carry internal to stealth aircraft out to 800, 900,000 plus miles. So those weapons become really large and really expensive. Plus their time of flight reduces their effectiveness against mobile targets, targets that can move really quickly, which is exactly what our adversaries are doing to degrade our effectiveness against their SAMs, their mobile TELs, and so forth.
So, gentlemen, in listening to what you're saying, I think what's incredible is that, you know, precision used to be getting the bomb on target. What you all are discussing is actually making the blast a guidable, shapeable effect. It's absolutely incredible, and it really speaks to a whole new era of precision that's really going to change things a lot. And I never really thought about it that way before, but it's really something.
Well, you know, Doug, here's another thing that's important, too, is when you take off, you don't have the opportunity to reload. So the adaptability, the opportunity to be able to dial a yield or dial the shape or dial the fragmentation of the weapon is now just as important as being able to select amongst different aim points within a particular target set. So that allows a single platform, single aircraft, when they take off, to have much more flexibility and lethality within the battle space. You know, with the cost per effect and all the different targets out there, I mean, thousands of targets, we need to make sure that we stay on the right side of the cost curve so that we're not imposing costs upon ourselves.
Exactly correct.
Yeah, effectiveness needs to be the principal element of the cost effectiveness equation.
Well, team, that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts on these important topics. And again, thank you, Mr. Donovan, for joining the Mitchell Institute. We look forward to seeing the impact that you and MySpark have on the space domain. And of course, thank you to our listeners for tuning in to today's episode of the Aerospace Advantage. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.